Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Big Ticket, Variety and iHeart's new film podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Today, we've got Jared Leto. He's talking about his upcoming Spider-Man villain movie, Morbius. And I also asked Jared if he ever wants to play the Joker again. And later, Kevin Costner. The Oscar winner is revealing to me that he's getting ready to direct again. It's all coming up today on The Big Ticket. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Right now, Jared Leto. I sat down with Jared at the Tribeca Film Festival, where he was premiering A Day in the Life of America, a new documentary he directed.
Hello, Mr. Jared Leto.
How you doing, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Just came in from London.
Yeah? What were you doing in London?
Filming.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What movie would that be?
It's called Morbius.
What could you tell us?
Not a lot. I thought about it, but then I'm... No.
You always wanted to play a vampire, didn't you?
I've always loved vampires.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I remember being at my grandmother's house in Louisiana, and, the original, the OG, would come on, mm-hmm. and just being pretty transfixed, as so many of us were when right. we saw that. Yeah, and then the Anne Rice era... Mm-hmm. was big for my brother and I. Remember we would pass those books around to each other.
And then did you get into Twilight?
You know, I didn't. I was just too damn old. I was too old, too jaded, too over prepubescent ideas of romance. But no, it was, I know, really big. Twilight, and then, you know, there have been others. But I always loved Gary Oldman's performance.
Yeah, of course.
It would be a great performance. Great, that was a real wonderful film, I thought. Coppola. Hunger.
Mm-hmm.
Great movie. That's a less widely seen
yes.
film, but a beautiful, beautiful movie. I mean, it was just beautifully shot. And of course, movies like Thirst, a Korean vampire film, really worth checking out.
So let's talk Tribeca Film Festival.
Yes, sir.
What are you doing here?
We're finishing a documentary. You know, yeah. festivals are great because they're really just deadlines for filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, obviously, it's a lot more than that. It's a celebration of cinema, culture, and a place to share what you're passionate about with people that are really passionate about filmmaking and films in general. But we made this crazy portrait of the United States and what I think is a really important time to take a look at ourselves.
A Day in the Life of America.
Yeah.
One day, July 4th.
Yeah.
How did you do this? What was it, like almost 100 crews around yeah. the country?
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, who financed this?
I did. I mean, wow. it wasn't the craziest thing in the world to do because, you know, the great thing about the times that we're living in is cheaper and easier than ever before right. to make films, especially documentary film. And that's great. Cause there are so many stories worth exploring and, so it was pretty down and dirty run and gun, but, you know, I was super passionate about the idea, and I put together this really hardworking group of people, and we just went for it.
So explain what it is. Is it slices of life just throughout the country?
It really is. We on a single day, July 4th, we sent 92 crews all over the country, had people in every single state, Puerto Rico and D.C., and we... turn the camera on ourselves, and we plotted and planned for weeks and weeks. We knew that there were certain things we wanted to capture, and then there were certain things that we hoped to capture, and other things that we didn't know we would capture that we did, and we were blown away by. But you see the beauty of this country, you see the contradiction, you see the pain, the hope. A lot of hope, and it's mm-hmm. incredible. And in a time where it's so easy, probably for people to feel a bit hopeless, mm-hmm. that there is so much optimism.
But an ugly side of America too.
Oh yeah,
you have the KKK in there.
Yeah, we have the KKK. We have the warts and all. I mean, I wanted to make an apolitical piece, and I really, that was a mandate that we all had, all of the camera crews and the producers, to take a good look at ourselves. I don't think it was important not to take a side. It's kind of hard not to, I think impossible to be completely objective, but we really didn't want to take a side. We wanted to hold up the camera and tell the story who we are.
What do you hope the movie does?
You know, I hope it continues a conversation that's mm-hmm. being had. As you can see, everybody in the film, it's not the first time they've thought or talked about these things, I don't think, you know, whether it's the opiate crisis or equality or diversity, whether it's Trump or ideas of America and the American dream. These are things that people are talking about. And for me, I really wanted it to be a time capsule that, you know, if you buried it and dug it up 100 years from now, you go, but you know exactly where, what time it was and what was happening in the world.
What's the biggest thing you learned?
Well, that a lot happens in a day. You know, we're all so consumed with our lives, you know, our busy lives, and you know, we're glued to our phones and to the news, and we know that a lot happens. But when I watch the film and when we're working on it, I think I always lose sight of the fact that it was shot in a single day. Hmm. You know, because there's so much that happens. There's so much, I mean, just the physical diversity in this country and the beauty of the United States is mind-blowing.
Is this a film you'd want to screen at the White House for the president?
I mean, I think that would be an interesting experiment. You know, I think I would love everyone to see it. I mean, Donald Trump is president. Donald Trump he's in the movie. So yeah, it'd be great if you watched it.
You said that people have hope.
I mean, these are the people that he's representing, right? You know, so I think that, you know, watching it would probably, you know, just be a one more avenue to understand and continue to you know, hear the voices that are, that he represents.
You said that there's a lot of hope.
Yeah.
Are you hopeful for the country?
You know, I'm a hopeful pessimist, I guess.
Is that the glass half full or half empty?
I don't know, or pessimistic optimist. You know, I think ultimately we'll get there, but man, we're going to cause a lot of damage. It doesn't seem like none of us really change until we have to. Mm-hmm. And it takes a significant amount of drama and trauma. We like to beat ourselves up quite a bit, I suppose. But it is a fascinating time, and the film explores that fascinating time. And, you know, we have the birth of children. We have people sharing their last words. We have incredibly surprising stories. We go from some of the most violent neighborhoods in the country to some of the most affluent. You know, on the 4th, when the sun set, I was in a helicopter above Los Angeles filming the fireworks, and we had another camera crew that was in New York flying around the Statue of Liberty and just filming this massive crescendo that happens in the film when the country celebrating, because I don't know if I said it all takes place on the 4th of July. Yeah. But yeah, it was a really, really, we had a lot of fun making it. It was really exciting. And usually documentaries, they're not often shot in a day or an hour, you know. So that was kind of fun, because usually, you know, you're shooting and shooting and shooting. We were buried in footage afterwards.
Yeah, how many hours of footage did you have?
I can't even tell you. I can't even tell you. I mean, it's limitless. We we also had 10,000 submissions from people all over the country and the world. Because I had, originally asked for people to comment and tell us who they thought we were. Because I was like, you have to ask your neighbors,
right,
too, if you want to get an accurate portrait. But we ended up using only the footage that our camera crews shot, for the most part. There were a couple of news reel shots. There's some news footage and some of the crowdsourced footage. But for the most part, that's what we shot.
Is a day in the life of the world next, or a day in the life of another
city? I mean, I'd love to do a day in the life of China, day in the life of Russia, day in the life of, you know, I think it's fascinating. Yeah, India, my God, that would be incredible.
Was there a group of people or someone you really wanted for this that you didn't get?
There was actually, it's quite a funny story. It was we found this amazing couple that agreed to let us film the birth of their child, and they were going to do an at-home natural birth, which is, you know, very brave in and of itself. And so we filmed, and, you know, luckily enough, the baby, it was coming on the day that we shot, right? That was the first big hurdle, and we're like, yes. And I was on the phone like an expectant father all day. How are we doing? She dilated, you know, and
is it gonna happen before midnight?
Yeah, exactly. And we kept checking in. It was like, oh my God, we're getting this amazing footage. She's in the bathtub screaming in agony and joy. And she didn't have the baby until the 5th. So spoiler alert, but what we did is we roll the credits and then we show the baby being born. But what did they name the kid? I forgot.
Jared.
I thought it should have been America, you know?
July.
Yeah.
Independence.
The 4th.
Documentary.
America the 4th is good. But yeah, that was kind of fun. And there are some funny
actually,
stuff
my niece
as well.
Was born on the 4th of July this year. I just remember it.
Oh.
But she's in Mexico, so it wasn't that special for her.
But what surprised me as well, how controversial some of the stuff that's in the film is. And it is, you know, that's us.
Right.
You know?
So Morbius.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about the superhero world.
Sure.
Avengers this weekend is supposed to make $300 million domestically.
That's it? Come on.
Crazy.
I thought it was going to be a billion, maybe worldwide.
How crazy is that?
Well, people love the movie.
Yeah.
You know, and they're great films.
How much did you love playing the Joker? I mean, I loved you in that role.
I loved it. I mean, I love these films because they get people excited about going to the movies again.
Yeah.
Or just period. I don't know about again, but a period. So I think that's a miracle. I mean, 5-10 years ago, I don't know if we thought that there would be people this excited about, you know, going to the movies this weekend.
Right.
So I think that's a celebration. And they've created a, you know, mythology that people love, and the actors are phenomenal. And I mean, I'm all in. I love it. I think it's a lot. It's a blast. And I think, you know, Hollywood's been making big, fun, epic films since, you know, the very beginning. This isn't something that's like, you know, I heard someone talking about, like, that there, if there's a downside to this.
What's the downside?
I think it's fun, and the movies are good. And what I think is great to see is that usually when you make film after film after film, the quality, you know, goes down. But
right.
It's kind of nice to see that it can, you know, they can challenge audiences with longer films,
right.
More involved plots, deeper character exploration. I think all of that's incredible.
So are we going to see you in Birds of Prey or what?
I don't think so. But you have to ask them.
The internet says maybe you are.
Oh, really? Well, we'll see.
Would you want to play the Joker again?
I would definitely play the Joker again. Yeah, I mean, it all depends on the script and the circumstances, as it always does for all of these. But you know, right now we're literally shooting. We flew over here for a day, So wow. We're shooting in full Morbius mode. And it's been a lot of fun, surprisingly.
Why do you say surprising?
Well, a lot of these films can be really difficult. And this film specifically has had some major challenges with the role and the things like that. But we've had a lot of fun doing it. And it's been an adventure.
Have you watched the Joaquin Joker trailer?
No.
No?
I haven't seen it. No. But you have a green tie in celebration of all things Joker.
Honestly, that's why I did it. And I knew you'd pick up on it. I knew you'd pick up on it.
Yeah.
Why hasn't the DC world hit as much as the Disney Marvel world?
Oh, I think it has.
Yeah.
I just asked Jason Momoa.
That's true.
I mean, I think Wonder Woman was one of the more exciting things ever to happen. It was phenomenal. It was a beautiful performance. And I think the DC world's been pretty great, you know, for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You can't win every single time.
Yeah.
But no, I think they're doing just fine. And I know people loved Shazam. I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet either. Yeah.
But people really loved that film. And, you know, I mean, sometimes you who's perfect? I'm not. That's for sure.
I found your Joker pretty perfect. You know I was a fan of that Joker.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And, I mean, I loved doing it. And, you know, we'll see what happens in the future. But I think DC's, I think they're doing okay, man.
They'll be okay. I mean, I'm not too worried about them.
No.
Okay, a couple of fun questions. When was the last time you cried at the movies?
1978. That Ricky Schroeder movie.
The Champ?
Yeah, The Champ.
That's not the last time you cried. I don't believe that.
I think it may have been. I had my tear ducts removed. Or at least it feels like it. No, you know what? I get teary-eyed on a plane more often than I do not. I don't know why that is.
Just flying or watching a movie on a plane?
No, just flying. No, I watching a film on a plane. It could be like, that was Dumb and Dumber 2. And I'm like, you know, I have a tear rolling down my face. There's got to be some science to that. I'm not sure what it is.
And what's the one movie you could watch over and over again and it just never gets old?
God, like 500 movies just came to mind. I mean, I really love the films of the 70s and early 80s, you know, that era of just kind of brutalist, mm-hmm. independent American film, you know, the Scorsese's and Coppola's. And, you know, I love Heaven's Gate, which is a movie that a lot of people probably haven't seen.
Mm-hmm. Why do you love it?
Well, it's funny because I didn't see it when I was very young, but for me, like Apocalypse Now and those kind of movies were made such a huge impact on me. But Heaven's Gate, I didn't see in that time that I saw all those other movies, because it was really a big disaster when it came out. It was considered a bomb,
right.
And I think
a big bomb.
But I was, you know, I watched it and I'm like, okay, this is the one that was supposed to be this disaster. But I found it to be incredibly beautiful. So I love all those films. You know, I think there's so much to learn from those movies.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thanks,
this
man.
This was great.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
That was Jared Leto. Coming up after a short break, we've got Kevin Costner talking about his Netflix movie, The Highwayman. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. And now we've got Kevin Costner. I sat down with the Oscar winner at South by Southwest in March, the morning after the premiere of The Highwayman. He stars in the Netflix movie as Frank Hamer, the legendary Texas Ranger who led the hunt for and the eventual fatal capture of Bonnie and Clyde.
What did you know about Frank? I mean, we know the Arthur Penn movie. What I learned last night when John Lee Hancock said that his widow sued Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
That was amazing to
me.
Well,
if you know a lot about it, he's like, you know, I mean, he was in two shootouts with his wife.
Right.
They killed people.
Yeah.
She had a gun. He had a gun. Hamer. Right? One was right in front of the courthouse, and they were having a trial, And the jury, everybody ran to the windows. And after the shootout, the judge declared it self-defense. Hamer and his wife.
Right.
And another time, you know, actually we had a scene that got cut out where Hamer and his wife are in another shootout and she shoots this guy, her former husband or somebody, and her brother also shoots him. And they ruled that it wasn't her bullet that killed him. And we end the scene with, how does that work? And just say, Texas. Right?
Right.
So what was the question exactly?
That, you know, that she sued Warner Brothers after the author.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah.
Because her husband stood in front of mobs and keep them from hanging people of color.
Right.
And other incredible things, and going, how could you possibly get this wrong? How could you possibly confuse my husband for anything other than a hero?
Right.
Shame on you for combining him with another character to serve your movie.
Mm.
And that family's lived with it. I got a letter from one of the great-grandchildren this morning.
Wow.
Feeling like that, you know, that they thought they were going to go see a story about their great-great-grandfather and felt like they were watching him.
Wow.
They had like a relationship with, you know, it's really in the pain of that. And they weren't you know, Frank wasn't murdered like other people were murdered.
Right.
But they murdered his reputation. Made me think, be more conscious as a filmmaker. I think I said that last night on stage.
What responsibility did you feel then?
Well, I feel that obviously I've always felt like you want to try to get it right when you're dealing with a real person. But in this particular instance, I have watched movies of, you know, combined characters sometimes, and there's economic reasons, like I said. It's like, geez, instead of two airplane tickets or three, you know, you're always trying to make your money stretch. Why couldn't this guy just say everything? And you make a decision about that. But when you're dealing with real people, you see the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Penn, if that lawyer took him down memory lane about who Frank, let me tell you who Frank Hamer is,
right,
versus who you portrayed him to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that Penn was affected.
If you could ask Frank a question today, what would it be?
Well, God, you know, my movies are long, and so would my conversation be. So a single question, I'd have to think a lot about that. I wouldn't even know where to start with that single question. I'm interested in his life. You know, there's some people are cut out for things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't even know it.
Right.
And they just are built that way. Mm. You know, and it's just he was one of those unique guys, like a Wyatt Earp that. It's like, wow, they're all in these same fights, and they, you know, it's like, why do they survive and other people don't? Measure of luck, measure of spontaneity.
How many bullets did he have in him?
What's that?
How many bullets did he have in him?
Yeah, it was not counting buckshot, about 16.
Jeez.
You know, and so, yeah, they're not, you know, for me to pretend that's who I am, I'm not him, but I could portray him.
And what's crazy about, I mean, we know the story. We know how the story ends, but even so, in the scene in like that dust field, and they sort of just disappear like ghosts.
Right.
I'm like, are they not going to get him? Like there's a point where
that dust field was a little bit of a metaphor, if you will. You know, not completely realistic,
mm-hmm.
but a metaphor that you could chase them and chase them and chase them. And Clyde was not uncommon for him to drive 1,000 miles at a stretch.
Wow.
I mean, hitting gas stations, robbing them as they go, but it was not uncommon. They were in back roads. And so so it was a metaphor, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they asked themselves that question, are we too old for this? Because he drove 400 miles and had breakfast. And that may have been a thing they used to be. And I think that Manny questions himself,
mm-hmm.
And I think it just fuels Frank more.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, Kevin talks politics and why he thinks Michelle Obama could run for president. And we're back with more Kevin Costner.
How has Hollywood changed? It's going to be 30 years Dances with Wolves next year.
Since what?
With Dances with Wolves next year, 30 years.
Really?
Yeah.
It feels like it's going to be 30 years for Field of Dreams and 30 years for Bull Durham.
Well, it's right. It's, you know, it's a
those
years.
Series of movies really, you know, it just shows you that, you know, movies can have that generational watch.
Mm-hmm.
They can. But on the surface, Field of Dreams, really? On the surface, Dances with Wolves, they called it Kevin's Gate. You know, on the, you know, on you know, Bull Durham, a little movie about minor league baseball. But it's like men and women. Their stories are men and women and, mm-hmm. and dreams. They're all three kind of very different. But there's something, you know, when writers get it right, and that's, I've always pinned my career on writing, you know, I feel it just, it props you up. I mean, mm-hmm. if you feel like it's you just getting by in your natural charm, you're wrong, because mm-hmm. you can't sustain it. It's mm-hmm. it's got to be the movie. It's got to be the literature.
Mm-hmm. What about directing?
I know.
What's going on?
I'm going to direct.
Yeah? What are you going to direct?
It's like tell us. It's like eating vegetables for me.
Is it really? Why?
I always think somebody else could do it better.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to do it. I'm going to try to play the second half of my career doing it. Mm. I've got a Western I want to do and about five other movies that are written.
Why is it so tough for you? Why is it like eating vegetables?
Why is it what?
Why is it like eating vegetables?
No, I maybe made a cute joke. But it's like I do, you know, I have, you know, the feeling that, you know, other people know the camera better and things like that. I just really, am, when I direct, I'm protective of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I may not bring all the tricks of the thing, but I won't miss the moment.
Mm. So when you're going to direct these next projects, are you going to star in them also?
I'll act in a few of them because it's just, you know, that's how I found the material, you know, or responded to it. Supporting part, sometimes lead, whatever. Yeah.
And I know we talked about this last night. I mean, there are more opportunities because there's just so many more platforms now.
You could there
do
are.
You could do streaming.
But I'm stubborn about where it goes and what the economics mean for myself and my family and for my partners. I'm real stubborn. You know, if it's just to work and create, you know, wealth for other people, you know, I've done that. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, these projects I own, and I just, I'm not going to do them for free,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I, because I understand that movies can still be playing 30 years from now.
Right, which they are. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you look at a movie like The Highwayman, and it has a theatrical release, but then it's on streaming pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Were you surprised by that? Or did you know that going in because it's Netflix?
I felt that. That was, you know, going to happen. Absolutely was going to happen. I think that, you know, John certainly made this film because he understood where it was going to go. But I think, you know, he yearned for it to be on the big screen. And I think that Netflix helped him with that idea and supported it to the length that they could based on their own business model.
Mm-hmm. What movies have you watched lately that you've been impressed by?
Oh, God. I don't watch a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. You know, I watch Solo, you know.
Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting. You know, I know I've, you know, I can't think. I'm a fog.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, with everything that's going on, it's a bit of a fog.
Right.
Right.
Back in, I just wanted to turn a little bit to politics.
Oh, I liked, I like Vice. I thought that Vice.
I mean, Christian Bale, like you literally just forgot it was him.
Yeah.
You just.
No, he was great. And that director, really, really nice. And that was really, really well done.
You mentioned Bison.
I thought Rockwell was great. Carell, and I just thought it was really good.
And I was just about to ask you about politics, and you brought up Vice. In 2008, you campaigned for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen in 2020?
Well, Barack can't run.
Right. Michelle can.
It's like when you say, what do you think? What do you know for sure? That's what I know for sure. Michelle could. Michelle is incredibly bright and articulate. And it's possessed of, you know, really, I think, good judgment and experienced a lot as a result of her husband and brings that, you know. So why couldn't she be? I mean, you know, the Constitution provides it. You know, yep. American citizen can do it. And so, you know, I doubt we'll see that. You're the one who brought her name up. But I tell you, she would have, you know, a level of interest for me.
Where do you see the country? One of the things I read, you said while you were campaigning for Barack Obama, was that your generation didn't change the world, and it was the next generation that, you know, it was their responsibility to vote. Young people to vote and change the world. Has the world changed?
No. I think we're going to look at ourselves and wonder what in the world we were thinking about. We have put our own careers, politically speaking, we've convinced our politicians and convinced ourselves that their being in office is or their experience is so important that they can somehow dismiss what a level of responsibility that they have right at the moment to do the right thing. I think 80%, 90% of America's problems are common sense solves that don't lie within one party or not. I think there's 10%, 15% of things that are really hard, and they, by definition, they deserve the word problem. They're a problem. How do we do this? We never solve a problem if we exaggerate or inflate. You have to look at a problem straightforward, and you can't shade it. You can't do anything, because the thing that's in shortest supply is good information, and that's what we all need to make great decisions. So, the political landscape is unrecognizable to me, and shame on us for being in that spot. And that could change overnight, not because of a vote, just because people say, you know, I want to try to be about more than myself.
And do you think that would happen?
And that's the definition of public service.
Right. Do you think that'll happen?
No.
Yeah.
No. And, we have a... This is the greatest experiment in humankind, America, this great idea about America, and it still exists. It's still here, and it's people still want to come here. But we're not first in hardly anything that matters. And we have an inflated idea about, how we are, I think. Mm-hmm. We exaggerate about what we are. We are everything that's great, and we are everything that's human, and our humanness is really our level of selfishness is overtaking our chance to be great.
Do you look at any politicians and say that's the person who could fix it?
No. I asked Castro that one time.
Really?
I was pretty close to him one time, and we were talking, and we were by ourselves, and I said, is there any politician, world leader, when you look back on your career that you didn't like at the moment, but as you get distance now that you look back and you go, they were good, they were straight with me? And he said, no, no one.
Wow.
Now, it was interesting. That was like, he wasn't impressed with anyone.
Right.
No one.
Right. Does that, I mean, I have to say, do you?
I thought he would say somebody that he might have been fond of, like, you know, that I now with distance.
Right.
No, no one.
Who do you look at from distance who maybe you didn't think was so great then and now? You know what? That was a pretty good guy, pretty good woman up there.
Oh, I don't, I don't take a deep dive on politics, I thought George Bush Sr. was a really good man,
mm-hmm.
a really good man. From being knocked out of his plane in World War II to, you know, there was just a goodness about him.
Mm-hmm.
He stopped everything that he was doing to allow my older brother who served in Vietnam to come into the White House and look around. It's just, there was a goodness. He understood the opportunities that he could afford other people, mm-hmm. He's not the only one, I miss the flavor of John Kennedy speaking. I think Barack was able to emulate that in a lot of wonderful ways. I'm anxious for conservative ideas to emerge, and I'm anxious for liberal ideas to meld with that, mm-hmm. because, you know, there's a conservative approach about how to do things, but there's a reality with 300 million people that people fall through the cracks, mm-hmm. and they are important, and they have to be looked out for, and not everybody in the world can pull themselves up by the bootstraps.
Has anyone ever approached you to run for office?
I've had people say silly things like that.
So my next question, have you ever considered it?
I would not do it.
Why not?
I just wouldn't do it.
Kevin, on that note, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that was Kevin Costner. Thanks so much for listening. Coming up next week, Halle Berry talking about that crazy stunt work in John Wick 3 and her directorial debut. She's actually directing a movie about female MMA fighting. It's all next week on The Big Ticket.